Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
When Kevin and I first started doing this podcast, we had a dream list of folks we wanted to get, and today's guest was at the top of that list.
It's true. Rob and I are really excited today because we both grew up listening to the music direction and vocal arrangements of today's guest. And you guys may have as well. Here's some of the credits. Mame, Applause, A Chorus Line, La Cage aux Folles.
And cult classics like Mac and Mabel, Dear World, The Grand Tour, Woman of the Year, and Foxy.
And those are only like a couple of the 24 Broadway credits he has.
You just exhausted me, you know that.
To tell us what it was like to collaborate with Jerry Herman, Michael Bennett, Kander and Ebb, Strauss and Adams, Comden and Green, and just about every other genius in the American musical theater. Here is Maestro Don Pippin.
Oh. Well, thank you for that wonderful intro.
Thank you for a wonderful career.
You reminded me of a story when you... Is that John Kander... There was a wonderful English comedian, Beatrice Lilly, had a Broadway show. And she had a piano team working with her, and they couldn't go on tour. So I was hired to be her pianist, and it was for two pianos, so John became my partner. So we were the two pianos that went out with her. Now, Bea was having a little trouble with her memory at that point, remembering things. So when we opened in Coconut Grove, Florida, at the end of the show, Bea came down and said, and I would like to thank Edie and Rack. And one woman leaned over and said, which one's Edie? And John pointed to me. And to this day, that's the way we communicate.
Are you serious?
I'm Edie. Whenever I get an email, I see Edie. I know it's from John. And I always send his Rack. So that's been our relationship through these years.
That's amazing. I love that you guys have known each other for so long.
Oh, and
that
you knew years, each other for years.
Before you were doing your what would become your professions.
Yes.
Where did you grow up, Don?
Well, Tennessee, basically, although I was born in Macon, Georgia. But at age three, I went to Tennessee, in Knoxville, Tennessee, until I was just starting grammar school and everything. And then I moved to Chattanooga, which became when I was a teenager. I was in Chattanooga, which is sort of a much more metropolitan city than Knoxville.
Did you have opportunities to see theater or music while you were there?
Oh, no. The only thing in Chattanooga was that on Saturday, I always listened to the Metropolitan Opera on the radio. But theater, I don't think there was any, not in those days. There is now. It's amazing how that city has changed.
Yes.
They finally had me back after 38 years as a guest conductor for their symphony.
And that's cool.
It was a thrill to see my name on the marquee of the theater that I used to see movies in.
Oh.
And used to sit out there and watch the movies, and now I'm on stage for their symphony. It was such a thrill to me, a very private thrill.
Yeah.
But when I was living there, it was a country town.
Well, how did you get your musical training? I mean, how did you find the desire?
I don't know how the desire happened. You know, I left Chattanooga just to get away from home. This was after I'd been in the service and the Army and everything.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to hurt my family's feelings of just saying, I want to get out of here.
Yeah.
So somebody mentioned the Juilliard School of Music, and I knew that was in New York. So I said, I want to go to the Juilliard. Now, that they understood. So I came to New York to the Juilliard School.
Wow.
That's what got me to New York.
And were you playing the piano at a young age?
Oh, yes. So I started piano when I was 5 years old.
Oh, okay.
I was lucky. I had a fabulous teacher. I was living in Knoxville then.
Right.
I had a fabulous teacher, Evelyn Miller, who was brilliant. I never had to unlearn anything. I just kept building on what she was a fabulous teacher and was kind of like my second mother in a way, so she was very close to me. But piano work I was doing, you know, in Chattanooga, I was playing at clubs and things and for singers. My first stepmother I introduced to my father. I lost my mother when I was 10 years old.
Yes.
And so I'd met Sarah because she was a singer at the church, and I introduced her to my father, and romance started, and they got married. But Sarah, because she was a singer, was involved in all of the social clubs of music, so I got to very early get used to going to these clubs and talking to people and presenting myself as a soloist, too. And so that's due to my first stepmother. She really developed my calmness of being around people and being a performer. I learned that very early. So that was kind of my life in Chattanooga.
Were you in the Army before Juilliard? Or?
Oh, yes, way before, yes.
Okay.
I went. What I did is the day I graduated from, I went to a military school, Baylor Military School, prep school.
Right.
The day I graduated from there, I enlisted in the Army this 2 days later because I didn't want to be drafted.
Right.
And I was very interested in medicine then, not music. And I knew I could be sent to medical school with the Army. So I enlisted and I went to University of Alabama. They sent me for pre-med. And that's where I was until they swore they would never pull us out of that, but they did because they needed soldiers. So I was then pulled into active service.
Wow.
But when I went over to the Philippine Islands, I went to the Pacific
War. What year was
it?
1944?
45, 46,
so
long
right
in there.
Right near the end. Okay.
Yeah. And so we were sent to the Pacific, and I was a frontline medic.
A frontline
medic. And once the war
medic.
Was over, and, you know, I remember the day that the atomic bomb was dropped. I heard all the news.
Yeah.
We were in the Philippines.
Yeah.
And my company, it was one of the first to go to Japan. I was one of the first of the 100 men who had our feet on Japanese soil. And that's where I stayed for about a year.
Wow, Dan.
And that's when I switched to special service and got in with the orchestra and got into entertaining. When I was in Japan.
In Japan.
I got in, and it was marvelous. And I also was an organist, and I played in one of the officers' clubs.
Yeah.
I actually did a dinner thing for General MacArthur and his wife. Just them. There was not for the public. And I was at the piano and played all the music for their dinner.
Yeah.
He was not very gracious. He never even looked at me or came over to say anything, but his wife did. She was very charming, came over to thank me for playing.
Wow.
But that was a big, big celebrity that I played
well,
for.
Well, he kind of was, I'll say.
By the way, in the Army, when I first went, the gentleman that I met almost the first day I was there, Anthony Benedetto, who later became, as we know, Tony Bennett. And we performed for the USO. We did a lot. And then, of course, he was sent, I think, to Europe, and I went to the Pacific. But years later, in New York, he hired me to be his conductor, so I toured with him. Suddenly, he was a star, and I was pretty well known at that point, too. And we finally worked together, and we went to London. We went all over the place, Las Vegas.
What a grateful circle.
Well, he was a great guy to work with. And he's still working. And at that age, it's amazing, but he knows exactly what his voice can do.
And keeping it current, I mean, he just did that album with Lady Gaga.
Well,
Come on.
That was fabulous.
That's genius.
I happen to be a big fan of hers.
Yeah.
And the two of them together is magic. But he is so brilliant because he knows how to use his voice still. He knows exactly what works.
Yeah. Do you remember the first show that you saw on Broadway?
I really don't.
Yeah.
I have a feeling it was probably a play because I had a couple of friends who loved plays, and probably I went with them to see. Could it have been Streetcar Named Desire? Yes, that would have been the right.
Okay,
I remember seeing
one.
It. It was very early in my career, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's a good one to start off with, I would say.
that's the bar.
That sets the bar pretty high. Ankles Away?
Ankles Away, that was it.
That's one of your first.
It was the first.
Yeah, dance arrangements.
The first time on dance. But dance music, and of course, the marvelous Tony Charmley was the choreographer. Uh-huh. And I'd worked with Tony, before I ever got to Broadway, I was very active in television, early television. In New York.
Okay.
Tony had been a choreographer, and we did a show called Stop the Music. We had a lot of dance music. That's when I started writing dance music. So I got the call for him to come in to do this big jazz ballet, which I did. And the show was so-so. It wasn't a bad show. It was fun, but it wasn't a big, huge success. Later, of course, I found out that somebody who became very important had been there to hear my jazz ballet, and that was Jerry Robbins, who called me in to work on a couple of shows, which I didn't want to do dance writing anymore.
Right.
but he certainly recommended me to a lot of people. So
yeah,
it was good that somebody, and he became pretty important, I'd say.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Would you explain to our listeners, what does a dance arranger do?
Well, what you do is you go in, you first, you're sitting, and I do. I like to sit at the piano and be the pianist for it. And you're working with the choreographer, and he has ideas, and he wants to do 16 bars and 3-4 and 4-4, and maybe this is jazzy, and maybe this is very classical. Mm-hmm. And you begin to just see that the music must certainly go with what it is he choreographically. And sometimes, if you have a good idea, you'll present to him, hey, how about something like this? And he'll say, oh, that's great. He likes that, so he'll choreograph to what you did. It works both ways.
Yeah.
Depends on who the choreographer is.
Yeah, using the themes of the composer, but also beefing them up.
That's right.
Stretching them.
Absolutely.
Whatever.
Absolutely.
You have to do.
I think sometimes the public thinks that the composer of a show wrote everything.
Yeah.
Very seldom.
So not true.
Probably Sondheim might do more writing. I've seen some of his sketches that he turns in. It's pretty complete.
Yeah.
But usually a composer is not expected to do that.
No, that's right.
What makes a good conductor?
Well, I think, first of all, the first thing I think with a conductor is I think your basic personality is important. I don't think just having a stick in your hand is the best thing to do. But I think, of course, you not only have to know your material, know what you would like to do with it, but you also have got to know what other people feel about the material, the composer. I'd say working with people. You've got to know how to work with people to be a good conductor. That means working with the musicians. You got to be aware of what they're going through, especially when you're doing a performance. You realize that, you know, maybe they've had a bad day themselves and they're not playing their best, and you've got to sort of encourage them, but you can't go up to them and say, why are you lousy tonight?
Totally.
You know, that's not going to help you. You're not going to get anything better.
Yeah.
Now, your first assistant conducting is Irma LaDuce.
Yes, that's my first time in a Broadway pit.
How did that come about?
Yeah.
It's interesting. Before that, as I said, I'd done a lot of things. There used to be something called industrial shows.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Automobile shows would do them especially, presenting their new products.
Right.
And there was the Ford company, and they had like six companies. I remember we all rehearsed six companies at one time in a big space. It was maddening. Stan Lebowski had one of the companies.
Oh, yeah.
And Stan and I became friends during that show. I never thought to call him, but I saw his show listed, or Irma LaDuce listed, and somebody said, well, why don't you try to get, you know Stan, why don't you try to get the job as pianist? And so I called him, and he said, you'd be interested in working in a pit? I said, absolutely, and I got the job from Stan.
Wow. That's incredible.
That's exactly the way it happened.
Were there any lessons you learned from watching him?
Yes, because Stan, I thought, worked far too hard with the orchestra. They got so they would ignore him, and he would then, he wasn't aware of that. Now, I don't want anybody to think I'm criticizing. He was a marvelous conductor. He was brilliant in the theater. He knew music so well. But as a conductor on a podium, sometimes he would be so heavy the way he was conducting, and we would start playing heavy, because orchestras will begin to play the way you're conducting. That's the one thing I learned not to do. So, but I'd studied quite a bit, so I was very eager to go. But that's when I got my first real chance to. I did a couple of matinees, and David Merrick, the producer, saw me do them, and so when the show went to Las Vegas, he hired me to take it to Vegas.
Oh, did he?
But Stan had left at this time. I didn't push him out. He had left for another job. So I was going to take over the New York company. So I went to Vegas and did it with Juliette Prowse starring in it.
Oh, my.
And she was marvelous.
Oh,
she was wonderful. And I tell you something very funny. You know, she had had a big affair with Frank Sinatra. That was well known.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Juliette and I were staying at a motel, not together, but we were having a little bit of a little. And we'd be out by the pool, and the phone would ring, and it was Sinatra. I didn't know it was Sinatra then, but she'd pick up the phone. She'd say, I told you not to call me again, and she'd hang up. And then I realized it was Sinatra, and I thought, oh, my God, if he knows that I'm with her, and he'll get his henchmen, and they'll come rub me out.
Yeah.
They'll come rub me out. That was the danger as a conductor.
And you were like, I mean, you were in your early 20s.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Gosh.
And then how did Oliver come your way?
Well, now, Oliver became an easier thing to come my way, and daringly so, because remember, David Merrick produced Irma LaDuce, and he'd seen me and hired me for another show,
right.
And I heard he was bringing over Oliver. And so I told his assistant, I said, get me an appointment, I want to talk to him. She said, you won't stand a chance because every well-known Broadway conductor wants the show. In those days, there were well-known Broadway conductors.
Definitely.
And I said, well, get me an appointment. I'd like to at least hear him say no. And she got me an appointment, and I went into his all red and black office. It was very intimidating. Everything is red or black. And he's sitting at the desk. He looks like the devil. He really did. Everything but horns. And I went up to him, and he said, yes, he acted like he didn't even know who I was.
Right.
And I said, Mr. Merrick, you're bringing over Oliver, and I want to be musical director of that show. He said, why should I give it to you? He said, but every well-known conductor wants that show. And I did something. I don't think I could do it today, but I walked right up. I practically put my nose against his, and I said, because I love the story and the script. I love the score, and no one can do it as well as I can. And he looked so shocked at me saying that. And he left me standing there for it seemed like 2 hours. I felt like if there was a trap door, I'd pull it and fall out of the room.
Totally, exit.
And suddenly, my surprise, he said, okay, you're going to have the show, and you better be as good as you think you are.
Wow.
And that's the way I got the show. And by the way, way down the line, when suddenly I was nominated and won a Tony for
yeah,
that.
You won a Tony for it.
And I leave the table, David Merrick, we're all at the same table, and I go back, and he puts his arm around me, and he says, you are as good as you thought you were. He remembered that I'd
he
said
did.
That. Yes.
He totally did. He must have seen something in that tenacity that he connected to, you know, that he...
Not just for me, which, of yeah. course, it's marvelous that he did. But I think that's why he was a brilliant producer.
Yeah.
He had great instincts.
He could take risks and
he always
paid
knew
off.
Who to put together and how to do things.
Yeah.
He truly was a genius. I don't think, at least to my knowledge, we have anybody like him today.
No, we hear so many of the... there's a lot of stories that go with David Merrick.
Oh,
know,
yes.
Horror stories.
Oh, yes.
The horn stories, as it
oh,
were.
Yes.
But he wouldn't have, we wouldn't be talking about him if he wasn't brilliant as well.
Oh, he was brilliant. Yeah. It's, of course, you know, in those days... A show, I think MAME, although that wasn't his show, but MAME, I think, was produced for like $350,000, which today would be probably $12
million. Please, yeah. Jesus.
So one producer could raise that money.
Yeah.
Today you have to have 20, 30 producers to get that
yeah.
money.
Yeah.
That's one of the
or
things.
Or Disney, yeah.
Yeah, but that's one of the things I think that is not helpful to Broadway, that you have to have that many people
all
involved.
Those voices, too, all those yeah. cooks in the kitchen.
What lessons did you take away from conducting for the first time on your own?
As I remember, I was very happy. I've never been an insecure person. And I mean, it's not that I don't think about how important it is. I do. I've always felt I don't do anything unless I feel I'm prepared to do it. Mm-hmm. I've turned down things that I do not think I'm ready to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you're well prepared and you know what you're going to do, why should you be nervous? You do it.
Preparation is everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
Were there any big projects you turned down?
I don't think I've ever turned anything down.
Well, in 1 year you do Oliver, you get the Tony Award for that, but then you also take 110 in the Shade.
Yes.
And very quickly, I'm so sorry, before we go to 110 in the Shade, what exactly did you win the Tony Award for?
Musical direction.
That's right, everyone. Music direction.
So at one point, the Tony Award committee recognized...
Yes, they did. I think it was only after 1 year after me. Somebody else did get another one. I was yeah. not the last person. Then they dropped it because they decided that no one understood what a musical director does. An orchestrator does?
That we can
That's
rate.
A big question.
There's no layers to that at all.
No. One of my favorite scores, 110 in the Shade.
Oh, I love it.
How did that come about?
You know, I don't remember why Harvey Schmidt called me. I really don't remember what the process was. All I know is that I was at his apartment, mm-hmm. and he and Tom Jones started presenting the music, and I just flipped. I just thought, because the score, you know, it's interesting how they write, there's almost a classical overtone to some of their writing,
yes,
the way they write.
Definitely.
And I had not had anything like that, and I was so intrigued with it and mm-hmm. fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And to work the show was really a wonderful experience, especially working with Harvey Schmidt, and because he's a composer, and he's a fabulous pianist.
Right.
He has hands. He can play at the piano, and his hands are so big. He plays chords and things that my hand won't reach.
Oh,
I don't have small hands.
You can tell in his scores when you try to play them. You're like, why are there so many notes here? Like,
it's brilliant. And, you know, yeah. he's not a studied. It's all self-learned.
He barely writes music.
I don't think he can.
Yeah.
I don't think
That's
he reads or writes
well.
It. Yeah. But, boy, he sure knows it. That's what counts.
Incredible. Yeah. That's incredible.
But, you know, Jerry Herman admits, you know, Jerry is not a reader or writer
uh-huh,
of music.
Uh-huh.
But you'd never know it.
Yeah, no.
Oh, no. You get in your orchestra rehearsal with him. You're saying, wait a minute. The third of that chord should be a flat, not a sharp.
Wow.
You know, I mean, he hears everything.
Totally.
Yeah.
Thank God. Thank God. Tell us some experiences about working on 110 in the Shade. Anything that you remember specifically?
Did it change a lot on the road or anything?
Oh, yes. That's a show we had to really work with.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the main problem we had was Joe Anthony, who was the director, was also the director of the play.
Mm.
And he did the Rainmaker.
Yes, and that is not always, I think, the best thing to have the director that close to a property. Mm-hmm. Also, the author had great troubles cutting, making cuts, which you have to make.
Right.
And he would come in with a list of cuts, and he'd cut the word but, the word and, the. You didn't get a real cut. And so that was our big problem with the show, mm-hmm. getting it so you could run it within mm-hmm. the time limit. Mm-hmm. But Inga Swenson, mm-hmm. I love that woman. It's a shame that her career has gone sort of comedic on television. Mm-hmm. She's never really had a wonderful thing to show her mm-hmm. great talent. Mm-hmm. I thought 110. And when I listen to the recording and hear her sing, how beautifully she sang that score. And she was just a delight for the whole show. Now, on 110, I had to rewrite the vocal arrangers. I didn't do the original. They had hired a well-known vocal arranger whose credit is on there. But he had written great vocal arrangements, but you have to be careful when you write for the stage because it's not going to be a group just standing there singing.
Right.
It's going to be spread out. You've got to realize it's got to work even spread out.
Yeah.
And I think I understood that why I've had very good success with vocal writing for the stage. So I had to take these quite often and rewrite them, although I had not done the originals. It's a great album. I don't really, I just am very thrilled with that album. It's tough. That's not easy music. And the thing that I'm so glad in that show, we kept casting. We couldn't get the youngest brother, Jimmy, I think is it.
Yep.
And I kept saying, I know just the perfect person. And they kept seeing other people. And finally, after about 5 days of auditioning, and no one they were happy with, especially Agnes DeMille. And I said, I know the... And finally, Merrick said, who is it and where is it? And I said, his name is Scooter Teague, and he's in California. And I just work with him in a nightclub act. And Merrick said, okay, I'm going to bring him here. And if he went on hire him, you're going to pay his airfare. I said, okay, okay. And they brought him in, and he came to me, and he was all dressed in a suit and tie and everything. And I said, wrong look for this. Take off the tie, take off that jacket. And he had a pair of blue jeans. I said, put on the blue jeans and mm-hmm. a shirt. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
The minute he walked on stage, Agnes DeMille, because just the way he walked on stage, she said, I think he can move. I said, he's a good dancer. And she had him to dance. She fell in love. The director loved him. Also, I'd gone over the monologue, the main one they made him audition.
Yeah.
And it told him everything the director wanted to hear in that. So I directed him in
Brilliant.
It. And he read it. And the director was floored the way he did that monologue. He just had every point of he wanted.
He gets it.
He got the job.
Yes, he did. Oh, that's really cool. And you didn't have to pay the airfare.
Nope, I did not.
Hey, listeners, Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars.
We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on Ratings and Reviews. Under the Customer Reviews, click Write a Review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
Jesus Shakes the Goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman Twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us your reviews, friends.
Please.
Noel Coward, I heard, was a backstage visitor too.
Well, he's one of those rare people that every time I even hear his name, I kind of think like, God, and I had a chance to at least talk with him and know him, because he's truly a legend. He could do everything. He, his opinions could be quite extreme.
Colorful.
When he didn't like something or when he did like something. I met him when I was in London. In fact, when I was in London that time, I met Noel Coward, Marlena Dietrich.
Oh my gosh.
When she was so big doing her thing. And I was really just, I don't know how I met those people. It just, they come into my life some way. But I love knowing them.
Yeah.
And not necessarily working with them, but just knowing them in the business.
Oh, yeah, it's special.
That's cool. I
have to ask about Foxy, because it's a show that not a lot of our listeners may know about, but also it involved a choreographer that is very important in musical theater history, Jack Cole.
Oh, yes.
That not a lot of people, I mean, he influenced so many other dance people that we talk about today, like Michael Bennett and Bob Fosse. But yeah. Jack Cole was had a language and a style of dance that was very revolutionary. But memories of working with him or working on that show.
Well, you know, the thing, as anybody will tell you that's worked with him, the problem with Jack Cole, he never finished a number. And I think it's because he didn't want to have to move away from it.
Yeah,
I think he had a reason. He would get to where you knew you hadn't quite finished a number, but then he would start on another number. And he would have maybe three or four numbers that he was working on, but no ending on any of them. And this was kind of maddening because I was having to make sure we had a dance room that had a finish.
Yeah.
What do we do? We don't have the choreography yet. How are we going to finish?
Then how can I write it? Yeah.
But finally, of course, he did eventually get them finished, but it was really quite a problem to do that. You know, John Davidson made his debut on Foxy.
No, really?
Do you know he was the ingenue, the juvenile.
The juvenile.
He sang a number called Talk to Me, Baby.
And Burt Lahr was in it?
That was Burt's brilliant musical.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, the problem with the show, they had done so many versions of it before they got to Broadway. That thing started up somewhere in the north. I had nothing to do with it that early. I only did the Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
But they had done so many different versions of it, and Burt had been in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
The director had done them all. And so by the time they had so many things going on in their minds, I don't think it could always say exactly what they should do.
Was Ben Franklin in Paris just as difficult as Foxy?
Oh, no. Ben Franklin was sort of fun.
Yeah.
Robert Preston was special,
yeah. Full disclosure, because there were some ghostwritten songs.
That's when Jerry came in.
That's right. The Jerry Herman.
Well, that's why that show was so important to me, because when the producers decided to bring in, they said, we're bringing in another lyricist, musician, to write scores. I didn't know who they were bringing in, and then I met Jerry for the first time. The minute we met, we liked each other. There was a personality thing between us right away, before he even had to work on his... And then he started writing, and he wrote so fast for that show. He did some wonderful things for that show.
What makes him such a great songwriter?
Well, I think, number one, the first thing I will say with Jerry Herman is, it got to have a melody. He instinctively knows how to write melodies, and they are not simple melodies. Some of them are extremely complex. And I think, and he's a self-taught pianist. He doesn't know chordal structure in terms of the way I would know it, but he does know the name of every chord. You can't fool him on that. And he sort of taught himself that. He just has an ear for music. He has a feeling. I think it's a feeling he has.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he writes words and music at the same time. He does not write a song and then set a lyric to it. No, it's right away. He starts right away. He hears the melody. It's Hello, Dolly. Da-da. Right away he has the lyric. And what he does next, once he finds it starting, now he decides what's going to be the last few bars. So where is he going lyrically with the song? Then he knows, and quite often he said, in fact, I saw him do this one. He's got the beginning of it. He's got the close off. And he now knows lyrically what he wants to do. And then he said, then it's easy to do what goes in between.
The journey, yeah, yeah.
And that's the way he writes.
And then you guys get to work together with him working there officially on MAME.
MAME, of course. Now, MAME is a show from the beginning to the end. There was never a problem. It had the right cast. It had the right director. It had the right choreographer. Anna White was brilliant.
Mm.
I was there for my department. Even the rehearsal pianists were brilliant.
Yeah.
Everything on that show, from the very beginning. Now, that brings up something which I really know is very important for Broadway, which is not done enough. That show did not go into rehearsal until it was ready to go into rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
The script was finished. The songs were finished. Everything was ready to do it,
mm-hmm.
to teach that show to the performers.
Mm-hmm.
And the right performers were hired for every role. It was Jerry Herman that got Angela. Angela Lansbury was never on the list to do that role.
Who was on the list?
Oh, any big name that existed in those days. We saw everybody.
There were so many.
Saw every well-known name you can think of, and none of them seemed right at all. And Jerry, I'd seen Angela do Anyone Can Whistle.
Oh, yeah.
That short show. I saw her do that, and I loved her in it. But I'd known her before that. I'd gone out with her once when she was doing a play on Broadway. I didn't know her well, but I had met her and been out with her.
Mm-hmm.
I liked her. But Jerry kept saying, and he really foxed them into it, because what he did, he personally contacted her. He worked with her on three of the songs. Nobody knew he was doing this. I didn't even know he was doing this.
Yeah.
And then they got an audition that she would come in, and he told her exactly what to do. And I remember she came in with she had a fur coat over her shoulders. She didn't have her arms through the sleeves, just over. And she, they said, Miss Angela Lansbury. She came walking on stage, and she just took the coat and threw it. This fur coat goes on the stage.
Wow.
And she walks over, and suddenly Jerry's gone to the pit and starts playing, and she starts singing, Light the Candles. Well, she knocked us out. We suddenly heard her sing this opening song, and we'd never heard anybody sing it but Jerry.
Yeah.
It just, everything, I mean, she practically had the job the minute she opened her mouth.
Yeah.
And then the director had her to read a scene. It was just brilliant what she did. So she was, I'd say, hired on the spot.
You saw that audition. That's
amazing. And Angela is still a very good touch. We just email all the time and we get together. And in fact, we've already planned, you know, we have our 50th anniversary of MAME coming up.
Isn't that incredible?
And we've been in touch with as many people that are still with us. Unfortunately, some aren't.
Yeah.
And she's going to be there, of course.
How special.
We're going to have it at Sardis. We're going to do it at Sardis.
So special.
Yeah.
Then after MAME comes Dear World.
Angela, the problem with Dear World, and Angela was brilliant at it. She really played the character with the makeup. But her public didn't want to see that.
No.
Her public wanted to see MAME again.
Yeah.
Mm. They didn't want to see her playing
it. So soon, too, just a couple years.
They didn't want to see her playing it. An 80 old lady. That's what she was, playing 80. And just everything. But I think Jerry wrote some lovely, lovely score for
that. I love
that
score.
Oh.
Then Applause.
Yes, I survived two shows with Lauren Bacall. I adored her. I think she was absolutely a fabulous lady. You know, she had total approval of cast and staff. And I was taken to her voice lesson the first time, and I heard her finish a voice lesson. And then we went down to the coffee shop to get acquainted, and we'd no more sat down. And she said, well, you heard me sing. What do you think of my voice? And that almost threw me that she would ask that right away. And I'd known and I'd heard that one thing she didn't like is people just not being direct with her. She'd like direct people. I said, well, you sound like a very musical moose. And she gave me this stare, but I got the job. I couldn't think
honest,
of any
way. You know?
Well, in a way, it did have that. And I ended up doing two shows with her.
Yeah.
And the score has a very contemporary sound.
Oh, yeah. Applause. Well, you know, Applause was supposedly, you know, the rock sound was beginning to come in.
Yeah.
And I remember, I'll tell you a story. Charlie Strauss, the composer.
Yeah.
When he did the score for me, so I could hear the score, and he sat at the piano and did it himself, and he has a very unique way of doing his song. And when he finished and everything, he said, now, Don, I've got to be perfectly honest with you about something. He said, I just wonder if you're not too old to conduct this show. And I looked at him, I said, Charles, if I'm too old to conduct it, you were far too old to write it.
That's right.
It made its point.
What was it like to collaborate with Cy Coleman on Seesaw?
Now, Cy Coleman, who was a genius, no doubt about
what
it.
A piano player. Yeah.
Oh,
jazz. Everything.
Oh,
jeez.
Yeah.
I tell you, his personality was just like his jazz playing. It'll give you an idea of his energy. But also, not an organized person in my way of thinking. You always had to sort of lead him to everything you needed. I remember I came in, by the way, I wasn't supposed to do that show. Marvelous John Morris, who was a big dance writer, was supposed to do that show. And something came up at the last minute he couldn't. That's when I got called. But it was like, I only had like about 4 days before they were going in rehearsal. So I got with Cy to go across the score. And he would play, but what he does when he starts to do something, he'll hit a chord and he'll say, now you know we could do this, and he'll change the chord, but maybe even this, and then,
like a real jazz.
Well, but not only that, you realize you're taking 15 minutes on a 1 minute number, and I suddenly realized that it would take us 3 days. I had to get out of there and write this stuff. And so finally I said to Cy, every time he'd play something, I said, that's brilliant, Cy. Oh, my God, how did you come up with that? And then we'd move on.
And then, okay, so musical theater fans, we love Mac and Mabel.
Oh, so do I.
We are dying to see it come back. We are dying to see it get its full due. What were your experiences like working on that show?
It was a tough show because it didn't want to work for some reason, and yet it seemed like it should.
Right.
It made sense.
Great story. It's got great music.
Fabulous story. I tell you, this is only my own opinion, and I will always stick with it. I think the pairing of Robert Preston with Bernadette Peters was a wrong combination of personalities together. I think they're both brilliant. I think Bernadette's very talented at certain things she does, but I do not think she was Mabel Normand, and I just don't think that worked. And I think I'm the only person connected with the show that would say that.
Mm-hmm.
She is a Bernadette, if you ever hear this, you're a great talent, honey. It's just I'm talking about casting. But I just think the two of them together, there was never something that made you believe this was was such a romance that the woman ends up killing herself taking drugs because she can't live without him. That's a pretty strong character she has to play.
Yeah.
And she did it, but to me, it just didn't come across right. Mm. And I will always feel that. Now, I've seen, you know, Mac and Mabel has been done about 3 times in London. Not London, but in England.
Yeah.
And I've seen 2 of the productions. And I think they work far better than New York because the casting was much stronger.
Right.
Still has, I think it needs to be neatened up a bit here and there. But I think it's a marvelous show. I do hope a version would come back.
I'm sure someone will tackle it at some point. Because it has all of the elements, really, for it to be a...
It certainly does. But I tell you, if we're jumping ahead to Jerry's other show, like Haja Folk,
yeah.
Of course, we opened in Boston. You know how daring it is to have opened in Boston with a show like Haja Folk with that theme?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, that's a little dangerous.
Yeah.
In the first act, as you recall, there's a lovely ballad called Song on the Seine.
Mm-hmm.
The very first performance, we were doing the show, and we were all very nervous, by the way, how the show would go in Boston. We realized that might have been a big mistake to open it in Boston. But we're doing it, and we get to Song on the Seine. I see this lovely couple sitting right to my left on the front row. I saw the lady reach over and take her husband's hand and put it up to her heart. And I thought, the magic is working.
We did it.
This, so daring, a man singing a love song to another man. That's not usually done, especially in Boston.
Yeah.
And that this woman did this because the magic of the material was working.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I think we got a hit show, and indeed we did.
When you first read or listened to the score of Le Cage, what were your initial impressions?
I loved it, except when I first heard it, it was over in Jerry's apartment. The Best of Times was not a song. It was just a device. It was just like the 8-bar theme. Mm. Repeated twice. It wasn't a full song. And I'm the one that night, as I was leaving, I said, Jerry, you should write a bridge to that song. He said, it doesn't need it. I said, yes, it does. You write a bridge to that and it'll make it a full song. And as I was going out the door, I turned to him and I said, by the way, make the notes long. You got enough short notes in the first 8 bars. The next morning, he called. I pick up the phone and he says, no, da, 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 da. He started singing the bridge. That's it.
Don is responsible for every song played at every bar mitzvah, wedding.
Oh, really? Is that where it's used?
It's everywhere. So thank you, Don.
Well, I love that song. And it's I love the fact song. That it is a complete song. And I use it in my concerts all the time.
Yeah.
George Hearn.
Yes.
And Gene Barry.
Oh, yes.
What was it like for these two men going into territory that musical theater actors did not go into?
Well, George, I think, was much more comfortable, except for the role he was having to play. But Gene Barry, you know, had not been on stage in years. Gene had come from the theater much earlier in his career. But he had become this fabulous movie and television guy.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, one of the nicest people you will could ever have known. And most people didn't realize that early in his career, he was a singer.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was known. He was a musical performer. He wasn't just an actor in his early career. So he had more, it was tougher for him to get back into live performing. George, of course, was strictly a live performer in those days. But the thing with George, it was so hard. And the director, Arthur Lawrence, was very brilliant about this. He had the high heels. He put them over. They said, now, George, when you feel you're ready to put those on, you put them on. The day that George put them on, the whole company, like, watching him in high heels, because he was ready for them. And there he had found his character enough.
Yeah.
Because he never played some put-on female. He played a very real female when he was Zaza.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it works so well. I've seen the show done where, unfortunately, they kid around with it.
You can't wink at it, no. You know, you have to respect it.
And then you don't have respect for it when that happens. Yeah. But he was brilliant doing that, and getting used to the high heels, I think, was his hardest thing in the role for him.
Mm. Let's go back to...
A Chorus Line?
A Chorus Line.
What a, I mean, obviously, it's a major chapter in all of musical theater history for the obvious reasons.
We always call it the ACL.
Right.
The ACL show. Well, you know, it's very interesting. It was Michael who called me for...
Michael
It wasn't Marvin Hammers that called me. It was Michael who called me. Of course, I'd worked with him very, very neatly in the other show.
Mm-hmm.
I went over to his apartment. Now, his apartment, everything was black. Everything is black. Such a dark apartment. And he was telling me about this show, and he was doing it with dancers, and he wanted somebody he knew that had some dance writing ability as well as conducting, because it was going to be dancers. And that's kind of the way it started. So I said, absolutely, you know, I would love to do it with you. But now I didn't realize that when I said that, there was no show.
They hadn't even created it yet.
No, not in a permanent thing. They had already had some of the interviews with the dancers, but there was not a finished script, and there was no music. So when I first go start rehearsals with the Chorus Line, we have scenes. I think we had one song.
This is at the Public, probably.
Yeah. Well, we weren't even there. We were just in the rehearsal studio.
Oh, okay.
But it was a musical with no music, really.
That's insane.
But this is where Michael Bennett was really such a genius, because he's the one that would decide there should be a song here. And he's the one that would get with Marvin and Ed and say, this is where the song, this is what the song should do. Mm-hmm. This is what you should write about. Mm-hmm. And he really gave them all this input. And, of course, they were brilliant. They'd go home and write it. And they'd come in the next day and they'd have it, usually. And I remember the first time that we were going to do At the Ballet, and I hadn't even done a vocal arrangement on it at that point. Mm-hmm. They just started out doing it in unison. And I couldn't wait. And I stayed up all night writing the vocal arrangement for the next day so they'd start doing it. And that's one of my favorite moments in the show.
It is a beautiful vocal arrangement.
I think that whole thing in the show, the way it works, what those three girls do, is so brilliant. And, of course, the cast was so brilliant. Because they really, you know, they weren't playing themselves. They were playing somebody else.
Right.
Like the Donna McKechnie part, she was playing, there were about three different girls' stories put together for her.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the writers could do that just amazed me.
Yeah.
They could listen to those tapes and then put it into dialogue.
And then find something specific and really create these characters that are so, I mean, the characters are so specific, so much so that, like, when the revival happened, they had the same positions on the poster, you know, the way they would stand there.
Oh, that's all. That was Michael.
That's just
I remember the day he told us, put him in a straight line, he looked at me and he said, that looks awful. Now, all of you just, how would you stand? If I didn't tell you how to stand, how would you stand?
Wow.
And everybody just sort of hit their pose.
And that became like the...
He said, that's good, keep it.
Makes a good director, in your opinion, from a musical director conductor's point of view?
To make him think every idea is coming from him and not you. I'm serious.
No, it's because it's so true.
No, yeah.
You must, I mean, directors are very egocentric. I don't know any that are not, even though I don't mean that in a particularly negative way. I mean just that they are like that.
Yeah.
And therefore, I don't think they lie. I think they are good because they don't clutter their mind with a lot of extra material outside of their own thinking. That's part of their being good.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I was serious in what I said. I think anything, when you want a major change, you have to kind of talk about it in a way that they realize they can make that change. Mm-hmm. That you're not trying to say, make my change.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in general, you have to be that way working with any creative people, even an actor.
Yeah.
Talk about the music director actor relationship a little bit. How do you approach a song with an actor? They're coming in on the first day. They've never learned this before. Here we go.
I think it's different with every person. You can sort of sense right away how they are acting as to how you can. For instance, like someone like Georgia Brown, for instance, who I adored.
Mm.
I mean, Georgia was the kind on any material, not particularly all of it, because she already knew it because she'd done it in London. But I did work with her on concerts and things. You would just do something for her, and she was so fast. You didn't have to repeat anything for her. It's like she got it the first time around. Now, some people, George Hearn is amazingly, he likes to break something down where he really knows exactly what it is. He doesn't want to know what note is that supposed to be. He wants to know exactly.
Yeah.
And once he knows, he's got it.
Musically. Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He's very solid. But I think it's hard to answer the question because I think every performer is different.
Yeah,
I don't, as a conductor, musical director, I never force anything on anybody. I never even present it that way. I never say anything like, this is the way you've got to do it. I would never think or even act that way.
Mm.
It's like, I will say, I think it works well this way. And probably I will even say, I'll do it and say, I think it works very well this way. How do you feel about that? I always want to know what they're feeling.
Mm.
I think that's the answer, Monique.
Do you ever discuss any of the acting, though?
Not unless it would be a friend who's in something that we would. I would never do that.
Woman of the Year. Woman of the
your
Year.
Second Bacall experience.
Well, now, the second Bacall, it's interesting. Right. It started.
The second Bacall.
And your first Candor, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Candor musical. Not
yeah,
you
musical,
guys had the gig together.
That's right. It's the only time we ever worked together. Now, I didn't start out Woman of the Year because I wasn't available. I was doing other things. Jack Lee. That was his show. But then he had a heart attack. And I'd heard that he was out. And it was the timing is fantastic because I was getting very bored with Radio City. And I thought, I didn't want to stay here any longer. I want to get out of this. And when I heard that he suddenly had to leave the show, and there was only like about 3 weeks, I think, before the show went in rehearsal, I actually called the producer. And I said, look, I'd be interested in that show if I can get out of my contract here.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, naturally, they were delighted to have me. Bacall couldn't have been more pleased.
Yeah.
So, and Fred Ebb, who I'd never worked with before. Fred was so funny. He was delightful. He was always very funny. He's the kind when you had a big number to do with a company, and he would sit with me, and sometimes I've written something, but still we'd, even though you've written your ad thing, something just spontaneously start doing things. And he would be the kind of somebody who'd say, I keep him saying, make it more complicated. Make it sound busier. Make it sound like it's more trouble than it is. You know, and he would always be saying these things in my ear. And he did. He just liked for everything to be so complex. Mm-hmm. Very funny. Brilliant writer.
You were with Radio City Music Hall for something like 14 years or so?
Well, off and on.
Off and on. Mm-hmm. Off and on.
Because, and I must say, I loved that. It was so wonderful to have this big symphonic orchestra.
I mean.
And these fabulous things on stage. And it was just, it was a dream come true. I'm sorry that I wish they'd been able to continue that way. But, you know, the public isn't ready for that, I guess. But we certainly did some lovely shows. Part of the Christmas show they do now, part of that is still what I did in 1979.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how fun.
Yeah.
So in lieu of writing an autobiography, you have put together a one-man show.
A Maestro's Memoirs.
Yeah. A Maestro's Memoirs. Tell us a little bit about what audiences can expect when they see A Maestro's Memoirs.
Well, they see a great deal of what we've talked about today, except refined down to where it's a little more pointed. But it really covers my career. I don't cover every show I've done. I only do the major ones that I think the public would be interested in. Mm-hmm. But I do tell a lot of the very, very charming, funny stories and get a lot of laughs. and I enjoy it. I've never been a performer on stage. This is my first time.
Well, I would say the Hollywood Bowl concert from 1994, you have a very strong presence on stage, Don.
Well, as long as I'm with an orchestra.
Okay, that's fair. But, I mean, that show is all about you as much as anybody else.
Well, I loved that, by the way. That was a marvelous thing.
Come on.
But, you know, all that is done so fast. You have one orchestra rehearsal and you're on stage doing a show. It's that fast.
Oh, man.
That's not something you spend days rehearsing at all.
I love that overture. Oh, yeah.
And sorry, just so our listeners know, it's Jerry Herman at the Hollywood Bowl, and it's a celebration of Jerry Herman's work.
Yes.
Don is conducting, and you will see. Oh my gosh,
he's in like a white tux.
Looks gorgeous. Looks stunning.
The whole Hollywood Bowl orchestra
and those performers. We had such
great performers. Leroy Reams,
Karen
Leslie
Morrow,
Uggams.
Whom I love.
Oh, I'll tell you a funny story. Yeah. It just came to mind with B. Arthur. Carol Channing. It was in the afternoon. We had to rehearse B's number with the orchestra. And over there's a staircase, as you remember, on the staircase, people come down. This is daylight time. Carol Channing is going up and down the steps because she's memorizing them because she has to come down them that night when it's dark and a spotlight is in her eyes and you can't see. And Carol's that kind of performer. She's going to make sure she doesn't have to see those steps to come down them. And now B is standing beside me, and B is watching her go up and down the steps, up and down the steps, up and down the steps. And now it's time I start the intro to B's number, and B leans over and says, "How do we turn her off?" I mean, to say that to me, and I'm playing the intro, you know, and then suddenly it's time for her to sing.
Yeah, totally. She nails it, probably.
That's amazing.
Those little things, you know, your life is full of moments like that.
Totally.
And then finally, before we go, what advice would you give to students that want to become music directors, people that want to follow in Don Pippin's footsteps?
Well, I think before we even get into the music, they really give some look and thought to what they're like as a person in relation to how they get along with people. Mm. I usually say they should study a few years of good psychology maybe before they start doing music, because I think a conductor must be able to communicate with the performer and also listen to the performer and help them what they need. So you're having to be almost more a person than you are a musician, I think.
Right. Well, you mentioned that you work with the performer, but also the orchestra, also the creatives, also all these personality types.
So I think a student should be well aware of what do they lack as a person. Do they get along with people? Do people like them? Because you better find out why they don't, if that's a negative response. And then I think, because otherwise you can be a great... Unless you're going to become such a big... See, you can be nasty after you're an important conductor, but not when you're starting. As we know, there's some big names that aren't so nice, they hear. But I don't think they started that way. They got that way.
Yeah, this is true.
But that's a horse of another color.
And you have never been that way.
I hope not.
No way.
You haven't. I hope not.
You haven't.
I'm not like that.
Next week, we sit down with poster designer Frank Verlizzo, whose works include the original poster art of Death Trap, Sweeney Todd, The Lion King, plus hundreds of others in his 40-year career.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.